Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A little bit of bonus open forum going on today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You can call with any question you want. 888-318-7884, the number, 888-31-TRUTH. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, has been doing this for a while. As a matter of fact, I always forget the number, but 27 years. Did I get it right? 20s?
Today, this is 2021, right?
Yeah.
28.
28 years. All right.
Awesome. Well, wait.
I like when an answer starts with, this is 2021, right? That gives me confidence.
You know, I'm kind of unstuck in time.
Yeah. It's become a little bit less relevant, all this time stuff. We're very timey-wimey now because of all the changes in our society.
28. I just did the math officially.
28 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So call. Get your question answered. 888-318-7884.
Well, like it's too, before it's too late.
No, I didn't mean it like that. I meant you were experienced at this before it's too late. Let's go to Mike in Boston. I always like when people from Boston call so I can hear a civilized accent again. Mike, thank you very much for the call. But guess what? I logged myself out. So hang on a second. All right. Now you can go, Mike. Go ahead with your question.
Hi there. How are you? Thank you so much for what you do. I really enjoy it. And I was hoping, Jimmy, you could clarify your talk on purgatory, which said that those souls in purgatory can pray for themselves and pray for us. I thought I heard you say that.
I said they can pray for us.
Okay. They can. See, I thought that I thought they couldn't do that either, but I thought that the reason we are to pray for them, which is an extreme act of faith, and that our prayers are even more efficacious to get them into heaven. That was my understanding, but I misheard you say. Yeah, I thought you said that they could pray.
So let's talk about that idea. That are you suggesting that we need to pray for them because they can't pray for themselves? Is that, do I understand correctly?
I kind of thought that.
Well, you'll hear some people say things like that. That wouldn't be church teaching, and it wouldn't appear to me to be a logical inference, because all praying to God it can take different forms. Well, one form it can take is worship. Psychella, do you suppose the souls in purgatory can worship God?
Yes, so much.
Okay, well, then that would be one form of prayer. What about asking for stuff for other people? Well, the church acknowledges they can pray for us, so they could ask God for other things. Could they ask for something for themselves? Well, I don't see any reason why they couldn't. Now, what the common theological opinion is that they can't merit anything new because meriting, which is a kind of cooperating with God's grace in a way that God chooses to give a new reward to, is something that, according to the common understanding, is something we can only do in this life. So it's commonly understood that once you die, you're not capable of doing good things in a way that will cause God to give you a new reward. And so as a result, the holy souls in purgatory would not be able to merit, and thus they wouldn't be able to do new things that God would reward by speeding their purification. But that doesn't mean they couldn't, but just because they can't merit it doesn't mean that they couldn't ask God to speed their purification or do something else. I wouldn't say that they're unable to pray to God, even in the sense of asking for themselves. I would just say it's the common opinion theologically that they can't merit anything in that state.
Okay, Mike?
Got it. And just one last quick question on the saints, which is another point of clarification, is the from what I understood, saints are in heaven, like, full stop. That's the church triumphant, correct? Like I thought that they wouldn't go to purgatory because they were in fact saints and triumphant.
No. Everybody who goes to purgatory ends up as a saint. That's the purpose of purgatory. It's the final stage of God's saint-making factory.
As a matter of fact, I think there's kind of a tradition of calling the souls in purgatory the holy souls in purgatory.
Yeah, and holy actually is just the word for saint. They're the sainted souls.
Mike, I really appreciate you calling. It's very nice to hear a Boston accent time to time. Hope you'll call again, but I'm going to keep moving because we have been very busy today. Brandon in Toronto, Canada is up next, watching on YouTube. Brandon, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey there, Jimmy. Can you hear me okay? My phone's a little bit fuzzy.
You're a little fuzzy, but we can hear you.
All right, great. Listen, I just want to say thanks for all that you do. Your book, Fathers Know Best, is like a fantastic book, and I use it all the time. But let me get right to it. So I have this kind of like proof for God that I've been thinking about recently, and because I'm Catholic, I know that probably someone else has thought of it before, so I just want to run it by you, and you kind of let me know who said this before, okay?
If I can.
Okay, so this is the idea. So maybe you can help me clarify it a bit. Okay, so I'm thinking like if the universe is like a machine, right, that operates by with matter and the laws of matter, right, that guide the matter, it should be kind of neutral towards its own existence, right? Like it shouldn't be in favor of its existence, or it should be unconcerned with existence. But there is something within the universe, which is life, that seems to be concerned about its own existence. So it seems to prefer existence to non-existence, at least life does. It seems to kind of tilt the scale, like almost in like a plus one, towards the universe being oriented towards existence. So existence is a positive thing. Is that something that who has said something like this before?
Well, you're touching on themes that have been discussed by a rather large number of people going back centuries. Now, we want to distinguish between mere existence and the existence of life in particular. But basically, the argument that you're making is, it sounds like, a form of what's called the design argument. That the world looks like it's been designed to prefer the existence of life. And to make the existence of life possible, it looks like it's been designed to do that. In fact, in recent decades, it's been pointed out by physicists, even non-believing physicists, that there are certain aspects of the universe known as constants, like the strength of gravity is a constant, the strength of the electromagnetic force is a constant. And there are a number of constants that if they were just slightly different, life would be impossible. And it's not just one constant that's like that, it's a bunch of them. And so that means we look like we're living in a universe that's not just designed to have life, it's finely tuned to have life. And so that has resulted in recent discussions of the design argument sometimes being called the fine-tuning argument. And the design argument itself goes way back. I mean, I would say you can even find traces of it in the Bible. But it's something that has been discussed for a long time. It kind of got a big push it's either the 1600s or the 1700s by a clergyman named William Paley, who compared the universe to like a watch. You know, watches have finely tuned mechanisms in them. If you're walking along the beach, you find a watch, you know the watch was designed by somebody because it has these elements of design in it. And he said the universe works the same way. So William Paley popularized one version of the design argument, and then there's been a lot of discussion of it since. Now, there's also counter arguments to the design argument, including the fine-tuning argument, but it is considered by many to be a very productive line of discussion and a productive line of thought for showing the existence of God. And I would suggest, you know, going to the Google machine and typing in things like design argument, fine-tuning argument, things like that.
Brandon, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that. And we're right up where we got to go to a break. So I'll thank you for the call. I'll take this break. We'll come back and do lots more calls. So if you're on the line, hang on the line. Right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
He is honored by the church as a saint with the title of the Seraphic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
One of the greatest theologians and Franciscan mystics in church history, Bonaventure also wrote a biography of St. Francis that was commissioned by the Franciscans themselves. It took a saint and true mystic to understand a true saint and mystic. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Hey, if you want another book to add to your giant collection of ebooks, we got a free ebook for you right now. Mysteries and Miracles of the Catholic Church. It's free over at shop.catholic.com, and you don't have to pay anything for it. That's actually what free means. I probably didn't need to add that part. All right, let's go to Anonymous in Virginia, listening on catholic.com. Anonymous, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your ministry. I'll keep this brief. A close friend's father, who is an Assemblies of God pastor, recently passed, sadly. In lieu of flowers, mourners were invited to donate to a fund established in his honor to fund the formation of other Assemblies of God pastors. Am I, as a Catholic, permitted to participate? And if the answer is yes, is it a good idea?
Well, there's no canon law that would prevent you from doing this, and this is one of those situations where, like almost every other situation in life, where you're dealing with people who are going to do some good things and some bad things, and if you go to the grocery store and you buy food, you know, you're giving money to the people in the grocery store, and they did some good by giving you the food you paid for. But, you know, they're going to take that money, and some of them are going to do bad things with it. You know, some of them are going to go home and get drunk or watch pornography or do something else they shouldn't. And so you have to make a judgment call. You know, as long as you don't approve of the bad that's being done, and as long as the good at least is equal to and preferably better than the bad, and as long as you're not doing the bad thing yourself and you're not approving of it, then it is possible to cooperate with imperfect situations. Now, there may be better things that you could do with your money. You know, you could donate it to a Catholic seminary, for example, but you know, and you could even, if you wanted, you could explain to your friend and say, you know, I really wanted to commemorate this person's passing, and so I made a donation to this other charity because I happen to be Catholic. Or you can just say, you don't even have to tell them what charity it was. You could just say, I wanted to let you know I made a donation, and leave it at that. So, so I would say you've got a number of options.
Great. Thank you, Jimmy.
Sure thing.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots of folks on the line. We go now to Chris in Boston. Another call from Boston. This is a good day, listening on EWTN. Chris, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Great to be with you guys. Long-time listener, first-time caller. My question, Jimmy, just has to do with the Eucharistic sacraments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a Eucharistic minister myself, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older, but as we sit around the kitchen table with friends or family, or I meet people on the way, what's interesting to me is the amount of people that I've come across, more recent than not, just do not believe that the Eucharist is the body of Christ and the wine is the blood of Christ. And it absolutely, and they claim to be Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And it just absolutely blows me away. Now, that's a statement, observation. My question is, how do you combat that? What would you say to them? And I know as a Catholic, we're not here to, you know, fight or bash, but
yeah, what do you say in that situation?
Well, there are any number of things that I could say. There are different approaches, and again, it would depend on the person I'm talking to. One approach would be to say, well, why don't you think that? And they may have some difficulty that you could help them clear up. You know, they may think, oh, well, it's impossible for a reason X, Y, or Z. And then you could show them, well, actually, it's not impossible, and here's how you can solve that problem. On the other hand, you could say, well, you do know that the church teaches this, and the church has good reason for teaching this, because this is the historic Christian understanding. Jesus said, this is my body and this is my blood. I mean, we hear that at every single Mass. And we have evidence he meant it, because if you look in John chapter 6, you'll see that he was willing to lose disciples. Even people who had been traveling with him quit when he announced this and wouldn't back down. Instead of backing down and saying, oh, come on, guys, I mean this symbolically or something, he was even willing to lose the 12. After he lost other disciples who had been traveling with him, he turns to the 12 and say, do you want to go too?
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically drawn a line in the sand saying, if you're not going to accept this, then you shouldn't be following me either. And St. Peter says, well, who would we go to? You have the words of eternal life. And Peter acknowledges, no matter how difficult it may be to accept this from a human reason perspective, Jesus is the one with the words of eternal life. So you can trust him, even if it seems hard to believe. And we can acknowledge that from the perspective of reason, it does seem hard to believe. But that doesn't mean it's not true. Just because something's hard for humans, that doesn't mean it's hard for God. God can do anything that doesn't involve a logical contradiction. And that's what omnipotence means. And so the idea of Jesus becoming really present in the Eucharist doesn't involve a logical contradiction. So it's something God can do. In fact, to God, everything he can do is equally easy, because he doesn't have like energy limits. It's not like God has a battery that runs down. And so God doesn't have limited energy, and so everything he can do is equally easy to him. So it is as easy to God to make Jesus really present in the Eucharist as it is for God to have a snowflake fall from the sky. Those are both equally easy to him. So you could approach it philosophically, the way I just did, or scripturally, the way I just did. Or you could approach it in terms of the historic faith of the church. You could show quotations from the church fathers that showed they believed in the real presence. Or you could take all of these approaches. And in fact, often that's the best way. You want to clear away people's difficulties. You want to show them how philosophically this makes sense. You want to show the biblical evidence for it. You want to show the evidence for the church fathers for it. And you want to show them it's the teaching of the church. And to find specifics on all of those, I'd suggest going to Catholic.com and just typing in real presence or Eucharist or transubstantiation. And we have a bunch of references, a bunch of resources there for you for free online that go into the specifics of all those arguments.
Chris, thanks very much. We also have a 20 Answers book, and I don't talk about the 20 Answers books enough, so we'll send you a copy of 20 Answers on the Eucharist if you'd like. Just hang on the line and we'll send you a copy of that. I'm going to go now to Derek in Texas, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Derek, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hi, I'm a big fan. So I had a quick question. I had a lot of people send me a story that's in the Book of Numbers about a woman who was accused of adultery, and a priest made this concoction, and she was supposed to drink it, and if the baby died, all guided by God, and if the baby dies, that means it was like she didn't commit adultery. If he did die, that means he did commit adultery. And a lot of people say that this is support for abortion in the Bible. What do you guys think about that?
So, Derek, you were talking kind of fast. I couldn't quite catch everything you said. Why would you suppose this passage endorses abortion?
Yeah, well, people use it to endorse abortion, saying that it was under God's will that the baby either lives or dies, depending if the baby
committed
adultery.
Okay, so this is a miscarriage understanding. Okay, so there are a bunch of problems with that interpretation. Now, for people who'd like to look up the passage, it's found in Numbers chapter 5. And it's a form of a procedure that is sometimes called trial by ordeal, where you use an ordeal that someone has to go through in order to establish a fact in a court of law. And trials by ordeal have been very common in human history. There have been lots of situations in many different cultures where trials by ordeal were conducted. And these days, we tend not to conduct them because there's been a general assessment that, like, if you have, let's say you have two guys, you know, battle each other with daggers, and you conclude, so they both go into this ordeal, and you conclude that the one who survives is the one who was innocent.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's, today, to most people, that's not a really great trial procedure. Because the one who, I mean, suppose you have an innocent 90-year-old man versus a guilty 20-year-old man in a knife fight. Even though the 90-year-old man is innocent, the 20-year-old is probably going to win the knife fight. So who survives the ordeal is not necessarily the greatest test.
They should just do who can walk slower.
One of the things you have to be aware of when we read the Old Testament, and Jesus told us this, so we're not just making this up, is that God picked certain and was willing to accept certain procedures in the time of Moses because the Israelites' hearts were hard. So God was accommodating the Israelites because they had these hard hearts, even though really what they were doing is not something he would prefer. It's just something he allowed. And Jesus cites this in connection with divorce. Moses allowed men to divorce their wives, Jesus says, because your hearts were hard, but it wasn't really what God wanted. And notice what we have going on here. Just like divorce involves a conflict between men and women on which in a marriage, between in a situation where the Israelites' hearts were hard, that's what we've got going on here. A conflict in a marriage between a man and a woman where the Israelites' hearts were hard, and just like God allowed the Israelites to divorce their wives, the Israelite men, because women couldn't divorce, here God allows the Israelite males to have their wives go through this trial of ordeal. But I'm guessing, because we know God doesn't ultimately prefer one sex to the other, St. Paul makes it quite clear that the sexes are equal, I'm guessing this is one of those things that God accommodated. And so we shouldn't look to the trial by ordeal for a woman who's suspected of adultery as if it really represents the fullness of God's will. And that means we're not going to be able to look at particular elements of it and say, oh, this must be part that is God's will. I mean, you can't just assume that. You'd have to make an argument of some kind to establish that. And that's going to present problems because this passage does not clearly refer to miscarriage anywhere. Now, that's not obvious in a lot of English translations. If you look, for example, in the New International Version, it will talk about how if the woman drinks the bitter water and she's guilty, then it will cause her abdomen to swell and her womb will miscarry. So that looks like it's talking about miscarriage. But that's the NIV is kind of a squishy translation. It's pretty interpretive. If you literally translate it, if you look at a more literal translation, it doesn't actually clearly refer to miscarriage. It talks about how her belly will swell and her thigh will fall. It doesn't say her child will come out. It says her thigh will fall. Well, that could mean a number of things. It doesn't have to mean a miscarriage. It could mean something else. I mean, it's clearly referring to some kind of abdominal issue or, you know, in that part of the body, but not necessarily miscarriage. That's really a guess on the part of the translators in other translations about what this is referring to. So it's not clear at all that it even does involve miscarriage. But let's suppose it did. The thing about miscarriages are they're not produced deliberately. They're called spontaneous abortions. That's the historical name for them, spontaneous abortion, as opposed to a deliberate abortion. And here, they're not deliberately causing abortion. They're putting a matter before God and letting God deal with it. And God, unlike us, does have the power of life and death. So God could legitimately decide whether someone's going to live or die. And if the person dies, and they're innocent, he can compensate them in the afterlife. He can give them a glorious eternal afterlife. But God's making a decision that's his decision to make, not ours. And so even if you said, well, this passage represents God's will, when it's probably something God's actually tolerating, and even if you said, oh, it definitely involves miscarriage, when really that's not what the passage says and that's not clear, it's not talking about what we mean by abortion. It's not saying, oh, human beings have the right to go out and deliberately kill unborn babies. It's at most saying God has the right to judge in this situation. Well, duh, of course he does, but that doesn't mean we can actively kill people.
Derek, we'll leave it there. Thanks. I really do hope that's helpful to you in responding to those who use the Book of Numbers to make that claim. Lots more questions for Jimmy Akin. It's open forum. The number, 888-31-TRUTH.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Matt Swaim here. Tomorrow on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the feast of St. Charles Borromeo, the great Italian saint of the Counter-Reformation, and talk Bible foods with Rita Heikenfeld. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Trick me into talking over the music, Darren. I'm not going to talk over the music. There's a little bit of groovy music for you. Jimmy Akin here, open forum. So you're probably thinking, it's Thursday already? But no, it's not. You're correct. It's Wednesday. We're just doing a little bonus open forum with Jimmy today, and we'll do the regular open forum tomorrow. 888-318-7884 is our number here. Up next is Donald in New Jersey, listening on Domestic Church Radio. Glad to have you, Donald. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Jimmy, I was wondering whether you have any ideas why the Pope is tolerating the Patriotic Church in China, and can he do anything about it?
Well, I think he's tolerating the Patriotic Church in China because he doesn't have any control over the Patriotic Church in China. He can't snap his fingers and make it go away because it's under the control of the Chinese Communist Party. What was the second part of your question?
Hang on, I think I put Donald on hold. Go ahead, Donald. What was the second part?
You answered the question. Mm-hmm. I thought he can't do anything about it, can he?
Well, he can't do anything directly because he's not in control of it. What he and his subordinates have been doing is negotiating with the Chinese Communist Party to try to arrange the best situation they can. Now, a lot of people have questioned whether they've made the best decisions You know, Cardinal Zinn, for example, has been rather critical of the policy that the Vatican Secretariat of State has been pursuing with respect to China and the church there. So, you know, people can have different opinions over, has the right approach been taken? Has enough been done? Has too much of some things been done? And that's a matter that people can reasonably discuss, but I'm afraid I don't have answers for you on that. I'm not intimately familiar with the details of the situation because, frankly, a lot of them are classified. I mean, even the current arrangement that the Secretariat of State has with China is classified. It has not been publicly released. I haven't read the details of it. I don't know what the negotiations were leading up to it. I don't know what the alternatives that are available are. I don't know what the consequences of taking those would be. I may have suspicions and impressions. And personally, you know, my inclination is that I see some merit in some of Cardinal Zinn's criticisms, but frankly, he is much more of an expert on this than I am. I know very little. I'm an American who has a passing familiarity with this, but I'm not an expert. I'm certainly not in on all the classified details. And so as a result of that, I have a limited ability to offer an opinion.
Donald, we'll leave it there. Thanks very, very much. We're going to keep moving just because so many on the line. Let's go to Angela in Indiana. Watching on YouTube. Angela, you there with us? No? No, Angela? All right. Hang on, Angela. If you hear this in a second, we'll come right back to you. Don't worry. We'll just head out to California, go to Pablo real quick, watching on YouTube. Then we'll come back to you, Angela. Pablo, are you there with us?
Yeah, hello.
Hi, Pablo. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hello. I don't know if this is something you could really answer or give me advice on, but So me and my wife, I recently came back to my faith. I guess you can call it a cradle Catholic.
Okay. Great.
The thing is, when my wife grew up, quote unquote, culturally Catholic, if that makes sense, but mm-hmm. not fully on, if you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're not really having like difficulties, but she just feels lost at the Mass. She doesn't know, like, the meaning of the Mass. And when she goes out, let's say, with her friends who are non-denominational or, like, other, let's say, Protestants, I guess.
Right.
They try to invite her to the churches. And I explain to her why we can't really go on a Sunday
mm-hmm.
because it's our, you know, Sunday obligation to actually attend Mass. But if it's, I don't know, to make it more simple, what is your advice to give to my wife in these moments?
Well, I would say that it sounds like that it's a good thing that she had a Catholic cultural heritage. That's good. It sounds like, though, that she could benefit from learning more about her Catholic faith and engaging with it more. Now, I know that sometimes, you know, like Protestant services can be, you know, appealing to some people, you know, because they can be exciting and things like that in some Protestant churches, in some of them. But, you know, hearing exciting preaching or music is not what should determine what church we go to, because what ultimately determines what church we should go to is what's true. It's what does Jesus want for us? And if you look in the Old Testament, for example, you know, God gave the Israelites priests and a temple in Jerusalem, but there were other competing shrines in Israel. I mean, they had shrines to Baal, they had shrines to Asherah, they even had other shrines to Yahweh, to the true God. And some of those other shrines were probably more exciting to go to than the temple. There were some lame priests, some bad priests at Jerusalem, but they were still God's priests. And he needed to go worship in Jerusalem where God's priests were. You couldn't say, oh, yeah, I know those are God's priests, but wow, the local unauthorized priest at the shrine next door
right.
here in my little village, oh, man, he's such a great preacher, and he really strums the harp with vigor, and it's really, and I feel so warm and fuzzy when I'm at his shrine. No, the Israelites still had to go to fulfill God's will, to go to Jerusalem and worship God in his temple there. And so I would say we're in the same kind of situation. God established the Catholic Church. It's the institution he created. He gave us priests. Some of them are great. Some of them are not great. But we have to stick with God and the institution he created and the priests he wants us to work with, even if they're not perfect. And we can't just look at what's exciting or invigorating or that we find personally appealing. We need to go with what's true. And so we have a, I assume we have copies in stock. If not, I assume we have it on the web. We have a Spanish version of a booklet that I helped write a number of years ago called Pillar of Fire, Pillar of Truth.
Oh, yeah.
That is designed to help people who don't have as much knowledge of their faith as Catholics to appreciate it more. And we also have it in English. So whatever languages, Pablo, that you and your wife are comfortable with, why don't we see if we can get you access, either a hard copy or online, of our booklet, Pillar of Fire, Pillar of Truth.
Okay, Pablo?
Okay, thank you. That'll be excellent.
All right, just hold on the line, and Thomas will get the information of where we can send that to you, or if it's going to be an electronic copy, maybe via an email address. But just hang on, and we'll do that. And thank you very much for the call. And please remember, we do open forum almost every Tuesday and Thursday. And if you ever have a question that you or your wife would like answered, we very much welcome the call. I'm going to go to Angela now in Indiana. Angela, you there with us?
Yes.
Oh, hey. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
I was curious about purgatory. I'm fairly new to the Catholic faith, kind of old new. I was raised pagan. Uh-huh. My mom went to the Catholic Church briefly in my teenage years and then dropped out. Mm-hmm. So I don't have much, but I was confirmed and baptized in the Catholic faith, and I'm just now coming back to it.
Wonderful.
Great. How can we help?
Heard you talk about purgatory, and that's one of my greatest, not concerns, I guess, confusions.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about it being a saint maker, mm-hmm. and I always heard it was like unbaptized babies and...
Oh, okay.
So they're different things. And now the place that people have talked about in connection with unbaptized babies is a place called Limbo. And Limbo is not actually church teaching. It's a theological speculation that is meant to explain why someone, what would happen if someone was a baby or, you know, mentally retarded or something, and they died without baptism. Well, since they were a baby, they don't have the ability to commit actual sins. They can't deliberately sin against God. And so they shouldn't suffer. You know, they wouldn't go to hell. But on the other hand, if they're not baptized, then they, unless God did something special, they wouldn't have the grace in their souls that they need to be fully united with God in heaven. And so some theologians for a number of centuries speculated that, well, maybe there's a place that involves, does not involve suffering, and it could even involve great joy, just not the full supernatural joy of being with God. And that's where unbaptized babies could go, and they called that limbo. Today, that's not church teaching, though. The church permits that limbo view, but it also permits other views, like maybe God will give the children the grace of baptism as they're dying, because the church would want them to have it, you know, so they have a kind of, the church desires for these kids to be baptized, and so they have a kind of baptism of desire, either on the part of the church or their parents or something. So the church sees that there are ways God could have these babies go to heaven, and we know he's merciful and he wants everyone to be saved, so maybe he does. So limbo is not a matter of church teaching. Now, how is that different than purgatory? Well, purgatory, the word means place of purification. And the church actually doesn't really understand it as a place. The key thing is a purification, because most of us, when we die, even though we're dying in God's friendship, and even though we've been forgiven for our sins, we're still not pure. we still have like disordered attachments. You know, you may just like that ice cream a little too much.
Why are you looking at me? Because you know it's true.
I'm not looking at you. I'm looking with you.
Oh, thank you, Jimmy.
So in any event, we tend to have disordered desires that can be with us through the end of our life, and we need to be fixed of those. God doesn't want us to be going through eternity with disordered desires. And so he purifies us of those desires. And the church refers to that purification as purgatory. We don't know a lot about it. It could happen all in an instant. It could happen in a place. It may not. It's been speculated, including by Pope Benedict, that actually what purgatory is it's when you encounter Jesus in the afterlife, that his transforming love burns away all of your brokenness, all of your disorder, and makes you perfect and ready for heaven. And that's what purgatory may be. But however you understand it, essentially, purgatory is the final stage of getting ready for heaven, where you're purified of anything that needs to be fixed.
Angela, did all that make sense to you?
It did, and I really liked the last bit.
Oh, good.
Me too.
It's called the Catholic faith. It's awesome.
Purifying you, yeah. That's really wonderful, and that gives me so much more, I don't know, it makes me...
Oh, that's right. She's still there.
My twin sister died while I was being born.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's hard, Angela. I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, God can reach unbaptized babies in that situation or any other, and we can hope for their salvation and entrust them to his mercy.
Angela, I'd like to send you Jimmy's book, Words of Eternal Life. I think you'll enjoy it, and I know you appreciate Jimmy's answer that he just gave, and he writes like he talks. So you can, if you'd like more of material that you can meditate on as you return to the church, I think it'd be a great one for you. Just hang on the line. We'll get your information and send you the Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness, and Where to Find It. We have to take a break now. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I've got a few things here and there that I've learned along the way. I'm always studying history, and I love studying history. So I try to bring in some of the historical perspective, especially at a time in our history when people don't know much history anymore.
Open Line with Father Mitch Pacwa, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith, along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and we've been working through the calls, so we've got room for a caller or two more. If you'd like to call and ask Jimmy your question, it's open for him, 888-318-7884, and please remember, anybody can call. You don't have to be Catholic. If you've got a question, you're welcome, 888-318-7884. Going now to Joseph in Michigan, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Joseph, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there.
Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Jimmy. I run a insurance agency, and we target various industries such as real estate, manufacturing. We can do restaurants and bars, and we're recently coming across potential clients in the cannabis space. Mm-hmm. And some of these clients primarily are growers, so they have a warehouse with their products and then their workers, and our job would be to insure those their warehouse, their products if they burn down, and if the facility burned down. And so I don't know what the church's stance is on if we're able to do that. I know, you know, we can insure bars and maybe liquor alcohol companies, but in the cannabis space, is that okay by the church's teachings?
Well, so the first thing I find interesting is the term cannabis space. I haven't heard that. It sounds really trippy. Cosmic, man. Now, having set that aside, you read my mind. You went where I was going to go. So essentially, cannabis is it's a plant that contains chemicals that have a psychoactive effect. And now I'm not an expert in cannabis. I have not studied it in detail, but my understanding is that it is widely reported that there can be legitimate uses of the chemicals contained in cannabis. For example, so-called medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may well be the case that the circumstances in which marijuana serves a legitimate medical function could be exaggerated. Because for a while, you know, in a lot of places, it would be illegal otherwise. And so I can see how some doctors might stretch it and say, oh, yeah, you've got a need medically for this when really you don't. So I'm perfectly happy to acknowledge that there may be fewer medical uses for it than is sometimes claimed. But ultimately, it's chemical. And it almost any chemical you can name, even supposedly poisonous ones like, radium.
Oh, yeah.
Can have legitimate medical uses. And so you can then debate, well, what are those uses and so forth? And you could debate it further. Alcohol can be either used correctly or abused. The same thing is true of cannabis. And it's a judgment call left up to legislatures. You know, where do we draw the line legally? When is the potential for use, for correct use, as opposed to abuse, so small that we should just say, okay, no, under... it shouldn't be generally available. It shouldn't be over the counter, other words.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm not an expert in, and it's something that has to be left up to legislatures to make that calculus. It's not something that falls directly out of moral theology because it depends on a bunch of variables, including sociological and scientific and medical ones that are really beyond the proper sphere of moral theology. So that's a judgment call left to the lady to figure out. Having said that, if a cannabis supplier is legal in a given area, I would tend to see it, unless I had reason to do otherwise, I would tend to see it as being in the same category as something like a liquor store. It sells chemicals that have some legitimate uses, but also have some illegitimate uses. And in this area where the liquor store is located, it has been determined that this can be legally sold. And so I would, unless I had particular reason to think otherwise, would say, well, I can sell insurance to the liquor store owner so that if his building burns down, he won't lose everything he's got. I mean, he'll probably just get insurance from someone else if he doesn't from me anyway. And in the same way, if a cannabis warehouse is somewhere that it's legal, unless something occurs to me that hasn't occurred to me yet, I would tend to look at it in the same light and say, okay, it's legal here. It's would be legitimate in principle to sell them insurance in case they burn down. Just don't inhale.
That makes sense, Joseph?
That does. That's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Well, I appreciate the call. Maybe
if
the cannabis space works out, maybe you move into the radium space.
A little bit more restricted, but there are medical uses.
Whoop. That's the sound just dropped out on us. Thanks, Joseph. Thanks. I really do appreciate the call. Let's get John in Fort Wayne, Indiana, listening on Redeemer Radio on. John, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, Jimmy. I was calling with regard to a question that my kids asked me during Mass. We were praying after the Liturgy of the Eucharist, and as the Eucharist was being reserved in the tabernacle, one of our kids turned to us and said, why don't they put the blood of Christ into the tabernacle? And so I really didn't have a very good answer, so I wanted to pass it along to you.
Well, the basic reason is that most of the time it's not stored in the tabernacle because the law says not to. The church has liturgical laws that that govern what happens at Mass, and under ordinary circumstances, it's not possible to store the precious blood after Mass. The regulations say to consume all of it. Now, there is an exception to that, which is if you need to take it to the sick who can't receive under the form of bread. So let's say you've got a sick person who has celiac disease, so they would be allergic to the appearances of bread in the host, and they need to receive under the form of wine. Or let's say you've got a dying person who is unconscious and can't easily receive the host, but they could receive the precious blood as their viaticum, as their last Holy Communion, through a tube. Well, in that case, again, you could reserve the precious blood after Mass, and for a time you could store it in the tabernacle. Now, the law doesn't say the reason why it's not to be reserved. At least my memory is that it doesn't say why, but I assume it's in connection with the fact that the precious blood is so easy to spill. You know, And in fact, that's one of the reasons that historically the laity haven't always been able to receive the Eucharist under the form of wine because the precious blood is so easy to spill and they don't want it being desecrated even accidentally. And so because chalices do not have screw top lids and because you would have to like pour it from one container into another, they generally don't want that happening because there's the danger of spilling it. But they do make an exception for cases where somebody is sick and needs to receive communion in that way.
Awesome. Yeah, actually, I was wondering if it was actually more of a practical thing too, that given the physical substance of it, that over time the wine that is the basis, it would go
stale, it would corrupt over time quicker than the hosts would. And that may be a factor that's involved too. But remember, you know, it does sit around in bottles for a long period of time and the alcohol keeps it from going stale. Where the corruption process starts is when it gets exposed to oxygen. And certainly if you had it out in an open chalice where it's exposed to lots of oxygen because it's not a sealed container, it would go stale even quicker. And that may be an element, but it wouldn't be the only element as far as I can guess.
John, it was your son that asked this question?
Yes, it was.
All right. Well, tell him he did a good job. And I hope that the answer is helpful to
you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Thanks very much.
So we're kind of close to the end of the hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking I would mention to people that tomorrow we're going to do open forum again.
Right?
Jimmy
yeah.
Akin will be back for open forum. I think Friday, Father Hugh is here.
Oh, and, cool.
And on Friday also, a new Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops, this one about the canals of Mars. Will you be talking about the gondoliers of Mars at all?
I forget if I mentioned the idea that they should have gondoliers on Mars.
Yeah, Martian gondoliers is a very good idea.
You know, something I was thinking about that is interesting, we mentioned radium having medical uses. One of the things that it was actually used for in the early 20th century was as a drink called Radiothor. And there was this millionaire guy who would like drink three bottles of Radiothor a day for years.
Aww.
And the problem is your body looks at radium because it's in the same column as calcium.
Oh, it puts it in your bones.
And it puts it in your bones. And especially it puts it in your jaw where your bones are under the most stress and need to be continually repaired. So I won't go into details, but he had some jaw problems.
Oh, that's awful. Yeah, don't drink the radium, kids. Don't drink the radium. Jimmy Akin, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
You can find Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World just by looking up Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You'll come across it. And we'll leave it there. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.